Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at KSFR.org, podcasting at SantaFeRadioCafe.org, and we're at Facebook.com/Radio Cafe. I'm happy now to welcome journalist Dar Jamail. He's the author of two books, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, and Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq, which you and I talked about a couple of years ago, Dar. And Dar is a journalist with the Interpress Service, Le Monde Diplomatique, and many other media outlets, and his stories have been published internationally in a dozen different languages. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
So you have been writing lately about post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, in American soldiers who have been serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. And according to military records, there are tens of thousands of soldiers who are physically and mentally injured, and to use the military term, non-deployable, but they're still in war situations, and they're still being sent back for further tours of duty. What's going on?
That's right. So far, when we look at the overall toll that both the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan are taking on soldiers in the U.S. military, it's staggering, to be frank. There was a RAND Corporation report, which is the RAND Corporation is a military-linked think tank that was released in 2008 that revealed that at that point, of the 1.8 million soldiers who'd been deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan, that a minimum of 300,000 who had returned were suffering from severe post-traumatic stress disorder and or severe depression. Now we're looking at a number of 2.2 million soldiers who had been deployed to both occupations. And of those coming back home, out of all of them who are even applying for help through the VA, at least 50% of those are being diagnosed with some sort of mental health problem. Usually that's the aforementioned PTSD or severe depression. There was a report that came out in late 2008 that revealed that at that point, more than 43,000 troops already diagnosed as medically unfit to be deployed had been deployed back into Iraq or Afghanistan into combat situations despite this diagnosis. It's a really shocking situation where literally we have people, and I've been speaking with some of these men recently who are literally diagnosed with PTSD, but if they're not imminently at risk for suicide, i.e. if they're literally not walking into a doctor's office saying, I'm going to kill myself right now, then they're being deployed anyway.
What are some of the symptoms of PTSD? What does it look like, both in war zones or in occupation zones and back home?
Well, PTSD, it's a very tricky illness to deal with because, you know, the key to that being the fact that it's post-traumatic stress disorder. So some people will come back and have a lot of trouble sleeping at night. They'll have nightmares about what they've seen or done in Iraq and Afghanistan. Their paranoia is a common symptom. They have trouble getting along with other people. They have trouble being in crowded situations, so they're a bit agoraphobic. Usually soldiers will come back and start self-medicating with alcohol or drugs, because when they go to try to get help from the VA, the average wait for a soldier getting help at the VA is about 6 months. So it's very tricky because also with a lot of people, a lot of soldiers will come back and seem as though, well, they're kind of on this pink cloud after being back in the States, having survived the occupation, and be telling their friends, well, everything's fine, you know, it's great, I'm just glad to be home. And oftentimes symptoms don't start to arise for several months and sometimes even years later.
And some of the symptoms back home affect the people around them. I mean, Fort Hood is an extreme example, but there's a lot of not only murder, but spousal abuse and things like that that can be a result of PTSD.
Well, exactly. And Fort Hood is a good example because it is probably the most extreme example simply because it's the largest U.S. military base in the United States and also the most heavily deployed. At full capacity, there's about 53,000 soldiers there. Right now, it's down around 30,000 or so because so many have been deployed, and now even more are being deployed from there because of Obama's announcement of a 30,000 troop increase into Afghanistan. But when folks come back, back home and then actually face these repeated deployments. So we have those that we talked about earlier who are already medically listed as unfit to be deployed. They're being deployed anyway. We have troops being deployed 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I've talked to people deployed 7 times, not enough time in between deployments for them to really decompress mentally and emotionally from the situation. And so when they come back home, they're basically time bombs. And so we have extreme amounts of domestic violence at home. We have extreme amounts of suicide just in the Army alone, and Fort Hood is an Army base. 2006 was a record number of suicides in the Army. It was surpassed in 2007 by another record suicide year in the Army. That was surpassed in 2008 by another record number of suicides in the Army. 2008 was also a record number of suicides in the Marine Corps. And then last year, 2009, was yet another record suicide year in the Army. And it's not a big surprise that we're seeing these trends continue to increase and break records of domestic violence rates, of divorce rates, of suicide rates, because we have two massive ongoing occupations that seemingly have no end in sight.
There's the whole horrible set of issues of what happens at home after somebody comes back. But I was thinking about what happens in Iraq, what happens in Afghanistan, what kinds of troubles are people with post-traumatic stress disorder likely to cause both to their fellow soldiers and to the people around them, the natives of Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, the stories we see back home, you know, we're talking about suicides and domestic violence and soldier-on-soldier violence, lots of murders. I mean, there's been actually a minimum of 2 murders that I know of personally that have happened at Fort Hood of soldiers killing other soldiers since the November 5th shooting spree carried out by Major Nidal Hassan that killed a dozen soldiers and wounded a few dozen others. But since that time, there's been at least 2 other murders, many, many other soldier-on-soldier violence resulting in murders happening at other bases since November 5th as well. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. All of this stuff, when we talk about domestic violence and soldier-on-soldier violence and suicides and post-traumatic stress disorder and soldiers being redeployed already listed as medically unfit, all of this is just the tip of the iceberg when we compare that to what happens when these soldiers go back over to Iraq or Afghanistan. This is one of the primary reasons why, for example, in Iraq to date, we're looking at a minimum of 1.3 million Iraqis have died as a direct result of the invasion and occupation. And then when we look over at Afghanistan, we're looking at tens of thousands of civilian deaths as a result of this. And this is because, and I've interviewed a lot of these soldiers myself firsthand, when they say, look, when I got over there, I was so afraid, I was so stressed out, I had PTSD, I couldn't get treatment for it, and I was basically in survival mode, as were the other fellows in my platoon. And so what that looks like on the ground is you become hypervigilant, you become enraged at having to be there, at watching people blown up by unseen enemies, and so you basically start shooting anything that moves. And so I've talked with countless soldiers who've talked about, they would say, look, if a vehicle came too close to our patrol, we would simply just, quote-unquote, light them up. We would just shoot first, ask questions later. We were encouraged to do this by our command because our whole goal was to get out of there in one piece and not lose any of our own. And if that meant just rampantly killing Iraqis or Afghanis on a regular basis, then that's just what we were going to do.
Which, when you think about it, is not only tragically sad, heartbreaking, horrific on every level, but it also perpetuates war.
Well, it does. It exacerbates the situation and really sets in motion, this kind of grim outcome where it's really only destined to repeat itself, where we have soldiers going over there and rampantly killing people, wedding parties being bombed, homes regularly being raided, innocent people being detained and killed on a daily basis. And so rather than this, I think both occupations are horrible ideas. idea. They're a terrible foreign policy disaster, and there's at this point nothing that can happen that's going to save either one of them. But what's actually making the situation worse is this rampant violence. When you have soldiers roll into, for example, a town in Afghanistan or a village and carry out this policy of detaining people, drones bombing innocent people on a regular basis, then that just creates more enemies. And that's actually, even U.S. intelligence reports are showing that more people are joining the Taliban today as a direct result of the U.S. policy there. We've even had several high-ranking people in the military that are starting to speak out against it, and some of them resigning in protest because they're saying this very same thing. Look, the U.S. policy over there is actually creating more enemies, and at this point, there's nothing left that we can possibly do that's going to change this situation, that our policies in both Iraq and Afghanistan are actually feeding, creating, and supporting the insurgencies there.
We're talking to journalist Dar Jamail. You write in your articles about psychiatrist Kernan Mannion, who was working with soldiers and veterans. Tell us his story.
Kernan Mannion was working for a private contractor at Camp Lejeune, which is the largest Marine base on the eastern seaboard. And around about last spring, he started writing several urgent emails to his superiors saying, look, I'm dealing with Marines who are coming back severely traumatized. They're being belittled by their commanders. They're not getting the treatment they need. And if these people don't start getting help, and if we don't have deep, radical, systemic changes in this system of so-called treatment that we're offering these guys, we're going to have some serious soldier-on-soldier violence, or even worse, a soldier going into the community and killing a bunch of civilians. And what happened is he had actually a couple of Marines that came into his office first early one morning at 7 o'clock when he got there and said this very thing and said, look, Dr. Mannion, if we don't have something changed severely, we're going to have a lot more suicides and a lot more soldier-on-soldier violence. And, of course, rather than changing the situation, the contractor was basically instructed by the Navy there, who was in charge of the base where he was. They said, look, actually, we want you to be quiet about this and just keep doing your job. Dr. Mannion felt strongly about what he was seeing. He saw the warning signs. He did not shut up. He did not stay quiet about it. He kept writing very urgent emails to try to rectify the situation. And so he was let go. He was basically fired. And he then went on to even write high-ranking people in the Senate, high-ranking people in the military, including the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, including the commander-in-chief, Barack Obama. And of course, the situation didn't change. And then, of course, several months later, we saw what happened at Fort Hood as a prime example of what happens when you have an overtaxed, debilitated system that's not able to take care of all the people that need help. And then more distressingly than that even is that when people are coming back home from the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan, and those that actually do have enough moral courage to walk up and request help, which is something that's actually frowned upon in the military, because most of us are familiar with this attitude in the military, lots of machismo is my point, is you're supposed to just suck it up, soldier. You're not supposed to be hurt. If you are, you're not supposed to show it. You're just basically expected to keep charging forward. And so when people come forward and try to get help, they're actually harassed by their commanders, and they're called sissies, and they're called wimps, and a lot of other far more derogatory things, and told just to get back out there with their unit and don't let their buddies down. And so this is a very, very big problem, and Dr. Mannion was very, very articulate in speaking out about it and continues to speak out about this problem, even though he's long since been relieved of his position and is raising a lot of hell about it, which I think is a very good thing, because so far we're not seeing the dramatic changes that have to happen in this system to correct these problems, and I think it's just a matter of time before we see more incidents like what happened at Fort Hood.
There's really a double standard between mental and physical injuries, although I would imagine that medical science would treat them both as severe. In other words, when somebody has post-traumatic stress disorder, it really is a medically diagnosed injury, just as if somebody's leg is blown off or if they have a stab wound or something like that. But it's treated by the military commanders as if post-traumatic stress were under the soldier's control.
Exactly. And this is another thing that Dr. Akern and Mannion was very, very clear about, really underscoring the massive severity of post-traumatic stress disorder. This mental affliction of itself is a huge thing for somebody to have to deal with. But then, as he said, we've never in the psychiatric community seen a situation in the military where people are being redeployed two times, three times, four times, five times, six times, seven times, and that he said generally with most folks around their second, third, definitely by their fourth deployments, he told me, I'm looking at people, I'm treating people who are literally in a state of psychological implosion, that it's the equivalent of basically having your total motherboard of your computer just shut down. He said it's not about replacing a circuit or fixing this or upgrading software or something. He said, I am looking at people that there's really no other way I can adequately describe this as aside from seeing people that are in literally a state of psychological implosion. They're literally shutting down. They're literally unable to function anymore as human beings. And this is the state of a lot of these soldiers are in when they come back home, and then they're being stop lost, and then they're being sent back overseas. Right now, according to the Pentagon, a minimum of 6% of the soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan are stop lost. So these are people that literally had fulfilled their contracts, but then are sent back overseas anyway because the military continues to be so short of soldiers to populate both these occupations. And again, when you really look under the propaganda and look under the rhetoric of, you know, this is about freedom and the military is up for the task and all of this, the military is in a state of breakdown at this point from what I'm seeing. And a lot of it is because, as you point out, these deep, serious psychological injuries are not being treated properly. I mean, it's basically the equivalent of someone having their leg blown off and blood is leaking out of their body, and they're being told, look, you got to get ready and pack your bags and head back over for another tour.
I would imagine that given the fact that the military is made up of volunteers, many of whose resources are the most limited of the people in this country, you know, people who are poor and don't have a lot of options, then when they return home, they also don't have a lot of options. For example, if they have to wait 6 months for an evaluation or for treatment, they're not people who can check into some kind of fancy clinic.
Exactly. And so this is why we have people that are basically stuck in this system, and a lot of the time they can't get out of it. And, you know, I can't tell you again how many of these fellows I've been talking with that say, look, you know, I am encouraging everyone I know, if you have any resources whatsoever, if it means selling your car or whatever you can do to go afford a civilian clinic and a civilian doctor, that's what you need to do, because they're going and seeing these military doctors that many of them are under so much pressure from their command, and this goes all the way up to the commander-in-chief who just ordered another 30,000 people to be deployed to Afghanistan. They're under so much pressure to keep enough boots on the ground that literally army psychologists are telling people, look, if you're not telling me you're going to kill yourself right at this moment, I'm telling you to go pack your bags and go back overseas. And so I recently did a story about a guy that literally went in to try to get help. It was suicidal, but not literally saying, I'm going to kill myself right this second. And so the army doctor told him, well, if you're not going to kill yourself right this second, then you're still deployable, and so I'm telling you to go deploy. And so he went absent without leave to go try to find civilian help. But unfortunately, this was an exceptional situation where he could actually gather together enough funds to go find a civilian doctor and try to take care of this on his own. Most folks join the military because of economics. There's no other jobs right now. Everyone knows the economy is in a very bad situation, so people join the military to get training, to get a paycheck, to get some kind of health care. And then, of course, when they're in it, they're barely making enough money to pay their bills. And if they can't get that health care from the military, they're just simply not economically in a situation where they can go elsewhere.
We're talking to journalist Dar Jamail. Tell us the story of Chuck Luther, who founded the Soldiers Advocacy Group of Disposable Warriors.
Chuck Luther is a two-tour Iraq veteran who came back from his second tour severely traumatized. And this was a guy who, he was a sergeant, he was very gung-ho, very into being in the military. He served for 12 and a half years. But when he came back from his second tour, he had severe post-traumatic stress disorder. And when he went to the military to try to get help for his suffering that was a result of his PTSD, the doctor tried to diagnose him with something that's become very common in the military all of a sudden called personality disorder. This is an important situation for people to understand, because what's happening in the military is this is kind of the rough equivalent where if you have health insurance and you try to get treated for something, and the insurance company is going to do everything they can to try to say, well, that's a pre-existing condition, so we don't have to help you with that. Well, this is basically the military equivalent of the same thing. So when Chuck Luther tried to go get help for his PTSD, the military doctor said, no, actually what you have is a personality disorder, and so we don't have to treat you for that, and we're not going to. And so Chuck Luther founded his a one-man advocacy group for other soldiers. He managed to get himself discharged from the military and get help in another way for his PTSD. And since that time, he's helped dozens of other soldiers deal with the same situation. He's helping file lawsuits against the military. He's even winning some of them, getting folks help for this situation. And he's been a huge source of help for soldiers at Fort Hood. He's kept himself based there at Killeen, which is the town right next to Fort Hood, and has helped dozens and dozens of other soldiers with these situations. But this is a guy also who, he's working two jobs, he's raising children, he has a family of his own, and yet he's taken it upon himself after having gone through this situation himself to try to help other soldiers. And again, it's a very commendable, admirable, honorable thing that Chuck Luther is doing, but it's still just a very tiny Band-Aid on an overall situation that is you know, the how out of control it is, and how much hemorrhaging, if you will, is going on as a result of this. That what Chuck Luther is doing, as great as it is just one tiny Band-Aid on this giant situation.
Well, and the commanding officers, as you say, have final word on who gets deployed, and no matter what the doctors and medical records of the soldiers say, the commanding officer finally is the one who gets to say you go or you don't go, and they have a tremendous pressure on them to keep the numbers up for these ongoing wars and occupations.
Yes, that's an important point, because not all military doctors are just writing people off and sending them over regardless. For example, there's been many situations where a military doctor will say, look, okay, this soldier here has PTSD and some other problem, and they're literally medically unfit to be deployed. And so in military regulations, if a soldier is listed by a doctor as medically unfit to be deployed, they have a minimum of a 90-day period where they're absolutely protected. There's nothing the military can do to send them overseas unless that status is changed, and they have a minimum of 90 days that will guarantee them that they will not have to be deployed before another step is going to be taken. And so even when doctors are doing what they can in the military and listing people this way, then literally the commanders can supersede that decision, can usurp their authority and say, well, you know, I know you're diagnosed that way, but we're going to send you over and you can just get... I've literally talked to one fellow who was told, look, I know that you have PTSD, but we're going to send you over to Iraq and you can get some PTSD treatment once you're overseas. And it really is that absurd. And because the military, what's very interesting is that the Pentagon at the end of just this past year, just last month, announced a report that they had surpassed all recruiting goals and set records for recruiting, all-time records, you know, since the all-volunteer force was formed in 1973, that they had set the records on recruiting. And it kind of made sense because, you know, all of us us look at the economic situation and realize, well, you know, of course, everybody, you know, a lot of people are going to the military because it's the only job on the block. But it actually has just been revealed by a journalist that this was bogus, that actually the military is still deeply, deeply strained, trying to find enough boots to send overseas. They don't have enough people, that actually those books were cooked, those numbers were fraudulent, them claiming that they had set recruiting records, because what they did instead is they counted a huge number of National Guard folks as in those recruiting numbers. So in the reality is, they're still not making the numbers, they're still overtaxed, they don't have enough boots on the ground, and they can't find enough people to send overseas. And that's why, again, we're seeing the problem just get worse the longer these situations, both these occupations, continue. It's why we're seeing a massive escalation in the number of contractors. Since Obama took office, we've seen a 25% increase of the use of contractors in Iraq and a 29% increase in Afghanistan, and these numbers are continuing to increase.
It's, of course, in the military's interest to cover these stories up, all these stories of post-traumatic stress and people not getting the help they need and people feeling like they're really kind of disposable, while they're trying to recruit people and give a romantic image of how strong and wonderful an experience it is to be in the military. What are they doing, if anything, to see to it that these stories don't go public?
Well, it's very interesting. Like, for example, when I've been covering stories of folks who are standing up and publicly refusing orders to deploy to either Iraq or Afghanistan, the military is doing a fairly good job of handling it on a case-by-case basis, solely with, I think, the main goal of keeping it as quiet as possible, because their worst nightmare at this point, being so overtaxed, it's so overstretched, looking at the fact that they're going to need to keep coming up with tens of thousands of troops over the coming months to keep sending over to Afghanistan specifically, the last thing they want to see is something akin to a GI resistance movement, something along the lines of what happened in Vietnam, because an organized GI resistance movement at this point would really make it impossible for the government to keep prosecuting both of these occupations. And so they're doing what they can to kind of suppress information, keep it under wraps. For example, there was one fellow at Fort Hood, a guy named Victor Augusto, who last May, having just returned from a tour over in Iraq, was told, well, you know, we know you're about at the end of your contract, but we're going to go ahead and stop-loss you because we need you to start packing your bags and get ready to go over to Afghanistan. Well, Victor Augusto decided he was opposed to that. He was opposed to both occupations after seeing what he saw in Iraq and refused to go and was very articulate about it, got himself a good civilian lawyer who was then going to put the war on trial to question the whole legality of the situation in Afghanistan. And the military saw what was coming, and they decided, look, we don't want any more media attention on this. We just want to get rid of this guy. So what they did, rather than giving him a special court-martial, which would have landed him in jail for about a year and he would have lost all his benefits, they downgraded it to what's called a summary court-martial, meaning Victor Augusto ended up spending less than 30 days in a county jail and then was discharged and still actually maintained some of his benefits. So they basically tried to just get this guy shut up, get rid of him, get him out of the picture as quickly as possible, get him into civilian life, because typically when they do that, a lot of these folks will stop going after the military and talking about it. So there was that situation. And then conversely, on the other hand, there was another soldier also at Fort Hood, Sergeant Travis Bishop, also an Iraq war vet, who came back, and same thing, they were going to send him to Afghanistan. He had applied for conscientious objector status, and since he applied for CO status, they decided, look, there's no way we can grant this guy CO status. We would then have everyone in the military wanting to do the same thing. I went to his court-martial at Fort Hood last summer, and literally the judge said just that. The military judge said, if you get CO status, all these other soldiers are going to see that they can do this, and they're going to want to do it, and then we wouldn't have a military, we wouldn't be able to fight these wars. And literally the judge said that. So you can guess how the court-martial went. Travis Bishop is now spending a year in the brig at Fort Lewis in Washington State. They threw the book at him. They tried to make an example of this guy to try to send a message loud and clear to anyone else in the military that might be contemplating applying for CO status. Well, you can do that, but you're going to pay for it and pay dearly, as Sergeant Travis Bishop is. So they're really handling it on a case-by-case basis, doing what they can to try to keep a lid on the growing number of stories of people in the military that are starting to step up and speak out and refuse to be part of what the government is doing in Iraq and Afghanistan.
We're talking to journalist Dar Jamail. You were saying a moment ago that there is not an organized resistance movement, but you just got done writing a book called The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. What is the nature of the resistance movement? A collection of individuals? Are they working in concert? Is there an underground resistance movement now?
Well, there's a situation where there's not an overall large organized resistance movement like we saw in Vietnam. I mean, for example, by the end of the Vietnam War, just about half the troops on the ground literally wouldn't follow orders, either because they were overtly refusing them or they were carrying out fraggings, which is using fragmentation devices like grenades to kill their officers who were trying to order them on patrols that they knew were bogus, or they were just doing so many drugs and drinking so much that they were literally incapable of following orders. But, you know, how this played out was by the end of Vietnam, when you have a military that just about half of them would not follow orders, it makes it impossible for the government to prosecute a war. So we don't have anything that even comes close to that now. Rather, we do have kind of a scattering around of individuals, sometimes maybe a small group. We have had a few platoons that have basically overtly refused to follow orders in Iraq, and that's actually happened in Afghanistan a few times as well. We rarely hear about this, but mostly we see just individual soldiers like the folks I had just talked about, or the Aaron Watadas, or the Camilo Mejias, other people who will just periodically stand up and say, look, I'm completely opposed to this, and manage to get media when they do it. There are some veterans organizations. There's Iraq Veterans Against the War, which is about 1,700-1,800 folks who are opposed to both of these occupations and are organized and having winter soldier events where they're getting media together and having a small group of soldiers that will get up there and tell their stories about what's really happening over in Iraq and Afghanistan, and sometimes getting a decent amount of media. There's other groups like Veterans for Common Sense, but there's none of these groups are really massive and really organizing powerfully enough on a national scale to actually start making it impossible for the military to continue forward with this agenda. So, again, that's why I absolutely wouldn't say there's a large resistance movement or anything like that. But that said, it's surprising to me still, even without a large organized national movement, that there still are a very, very large number of cases, usually on an individual level, of folks that are putting it all on the line to refuse to go to Iraq or Afghanistan, literally knowing that if they refuse these orders, they're going to do some serious jail time, they're going to lose their benefits, they're going to lose the esteem of their peers, they're going to, really putting it all on the line, and yet still finding it morally necessary and legally necessary for them to do this. And I think that's very, very commendable that we're seeing as much as we are, even without a national movement.
When you look at the big picture of the military that's engaged in Iraq and Afghanistan, how is morale across the board? I mean, there are these horrible cases that you're talking about, and there's post-traumatic stress. But when you look at the big picture, do the soldiers, by and large, believe in the wars and occupations they're taking part in, or not so much?
Morale is at an all-time low. Everyone I'm talking with in the military, whether it's folks like Chuck Luther, who's working with dozens of soldiers on any given day right there at Fort Hood, or folks I'm talking with who are still active duty in the military at various bases around the country, or folks who've already discharged, judge, the consensus is that morale is extremely low. And the reason, the primary reason for this, in addition to what we've talked about with repeated deployments and untreated mental health problems and people's inability to actually get help from the VA when they do go, really it's the lack of a clearly defined mission in both occupations. The fact that they're both open-ended occupations. I talk with a guy named Michael Kern, an active duty soldier at a specialist at Fort Hood, who's served a couple of tours over in Iraq, and he said, look, morale is so low because nobody knows when these are going to end. And no matter all the people that I talked to, and this is what he was telling me, all the people that I talked to said that whether they're gung-ho pro-war soldiers or folks that are already clearly against both these occupations, morale is low because everyone agrees, look, if there's no clearly defined mission, we don't know when we're going to get the hell out of either of these occupations, that's just not going to help morale. And so it's very, very low. People are staying in primarily, from what I'm seeing, for two main reasons. One, economics, because they're afraid to get out. They're afraid they won't be able to get a job and get medical benefits, and if they have a family to support their families, and two, loyalty to their buddies. One thing the military did change after Vietnam, learning hard lessons in Vietnam from the GI resistance movement then, is unit cohesion. They learned if we keep people in units together over long periods of time, they're going to make friends with people in their units, and even if their morale starts to sag and they turn against the war, if they have a buddy that's going to still go over for whatever reason, then they're going to go just to watch their buddies back. And that's become very, very common. So the two main reasons why folks are staying in now, it's not out of patriotism, it's not out of wanting to help people in Iraq or Afghanistan. I mean, they see the bogus nature of both these occupations. They know it's not about helping anyone in Iraq or Afghanistan. They know it's not about freedom or liberating people or any of or national security or any of this nonsense. They're going simply because of economics or because they want to watch their buddies back.
One of the groups within the military that seems to be the most vulnerable is American soldiers of Middle Eastern origin, some of whom are very harshly treated by their own fellow soldiers.
Well, exactly. And when we look at Sergeant Major Hassan over, Nidal Hassan over at Fort Hood, the man who carried out this horrific shooting spree last November 5th, this is a case in point, and it's come out in the aftermath of that whole thing, where this is a guy who was Muslim, of Middle Eastern descent, and despite the fact that he joined the military at an early age and had served a lot of years and was very loyal to it and proud of his service, he had received incessant, especially after September 11, 2001, he had received incessant batterings and being harassed for being a Muslim. You know, like people, I talked to folks at Fort Hood who said, you know, leading up to the incident on November 5th, that Major Hassan would regularly come back and find notes on his car that say things like, my other car is a camel, and, leave this country, go wage your own jihad, you know, this kind of stuff, and regularly being harassed by his command for being a Muslim and other soldiers. And this is, you know, of course, that was only one factor of what led him to do what he did on November 5th. But I've talked with other folks, and in fact, one a soldier of Iraqi descent. This is a guy who is a U.S. citizen, joined the military, was very proud of his service, had worked with the military intelligence over in Iraq, and then again came back, tried to get help for his PTSD, and was instead being very, very harassed for being a Muslim, people in the military not trusting him, giving him all kinds of problems for this. And again, when we consider the fact that there's thousands of Muslims actively serving in the U.S. military today, most of them very, very proud to be part of the military, and yet now they're being harassed simply because of their religion. This does not bode well for the future. I'm not saying that we should expect more Sergeant Hassan or Major Hassans because simply for harassment because of their religion, but simply it's going to again damage morale overall, cause more schisms in the military, and certainly this is something that any Muslim now thinking of joining the military today had better think twice.
Well, and as you write about, part of the culture of the military is by nature dehumanizing. If you want to take a group of young men and women and teach them to kill on command, you have to dehumanize them to some extent, and then they take that dehumanization not only to other soldiers, but civilians in other countries and to each other.
Exactly. And I think that's really, a bedrock premise upon which everything that we're talking about right now stands, and that is that it only makes sense that this kind of thing is going to happen when you have a massive institution like the U.S. military that is absolutely the most racist, misogynistic institution on the planet, and that's primarily because when you bring people in and you run them through boot camp, basic training, and they are literally brainwashed, running around with a group of 10, 15 people, jogging, chanting things like kill, 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 blood, 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 you know, this kind of thing, and that's no exaggeration whatsoever, literally getting it to where these people will actively go out and follow a command without questioning it to kill and do whatever their commander tells them to do, it only leads logically to the fact that then they're going to treat each other that way. That's why, for example, one out of three women in the U.S. military will be raped or sexually assaulted by the end of their contract. That's why there's so much soldier-on-soldier violence. That's why there is prejudice against someone's religion and so much racism and misogyny in the U.S. military. It's because this is a massive group of people that are dehumanized each other. They're dehumanized themselves first, and then they dehumanize each other, and that's just part and parcel of what goes along with when you dehumanize Iraqis and Afghanis so that people can go over and occupy their country and carry out horrible orders that they're told to do. It only is a given, I think, really, logically, that they're going to be treating each other as they are, and certainly then go overseas and treat Iraqis and Afghanis as they are.
And I think it's important that you brought up the issue of women who are likely to be raped by their fellow soldiers, and they are also a very large PTSD vulnerable population.
They are, actually, even much more so than the men, because they tend to be a little bit more in touch with their feelings, even despite going through basic training, than men in the military. Part of that is certainly due to expectations in the military on men as opposed to women. Men are actually simply expected to be much more violent and ready to be violent on a moment's notice. And so women actually in the military pay a much more severe price when they go overseas for not only are they actually more likely to be raped or sexually assaulted by another soldier than they are statistically likely to be injured or killed in combat, which is a shocking statistic. I mean, it's more dangerous for women just simply from the threats they face of sexual assault from another soldier than it is for them to go over and participate in the occupation of Afghanistan or Iraq. So there's that factor, and then there's, of course, the PTSD and everything else that we're talking about with women, where it's that much more severe for them precisely because the military is such a misogynistic institution that when a woman tries to go get help, again, you know, there's a totally different set of standards for women in the military, where many of the women I've interviewed for the book that I wrote said, look, we had to outperform all the men just to try to get respect. So think about then how that plays out if you have a woman soldier with PTSD that tries to go get help in that system. How's that going to play out?
Meanwhile, we still have, even as gay marriage is being legalized in more and more states, we have still quite an anti-gay culture within the military.
Oh, very much so. Homophobia in the military is rampant. I have a whole chapter on this in the book because it's just really unbelievable where, you know, of course, we have the whole don't ask, don't tell thing that we can thank Bill Clinton for, this absurd policy that basically is based on lies, where if you're gay, you're allowed to join the military, but you can't talk about it or you'll be kicked out, but and no one in the military is technically allowed to ask you about your sexual orientation. orientation. But we have a lot of resistance happening now in the military against that, because there's a sizable percentage of gays in the military. And it's funny. One individual, for example, I interviewed for my book, a Marine Lance Corporal named Jeff Key, who was a Iraq War veteran. He came back and was opposed to the occupation because of what he saw happening over there. And he decided to use Don't Ask, Don't Tell to his advantage. And so he was asked to go on the Paula Zahn Now show on CNN on March 31, 2004, to talk about morale in the military in the wake of the killing of the four Blackwater mercenaries in Fallujah. And Jeff Key went on CNN in front of about 7 million people and came out on national TV as a gay Marine. So, of course, the military had to let him go. So that is certainly an exceptional example of soldiers who are finding very interesting and creative ways to fight back against Don't Ask, Don't Tell and homophobia in the military. But there's many, many other instances happening even now of soldiers, gay people in the military, saying, you know, I'm not going to be part of this system. I'm not going to lie about my sexual orientation anymore. And they're finding creative ways to get out of the military.
Now, in the time that we've been talking, we're talking to journalist Dar Jamail, you've told a lot of stories about the military, about Iraq and Afghanistan, today about post-traumatic stress disorder. How are these being represented in the mainstream media? Is there coverage?
Well, mostly, you know, we have had some coverage in the mainstream of the fact that, you know, there's a crisis in the military, in that there's not enough help at the VA, that people in the military are not getting the treatment that they deserve and have already earned. So there's been some coverage of that. But when we really talk about, you know, most of the things that we've talked about today, about, you know, the repeated deployments, about people being sent over already diagnosed as medically unfit for deployment, of homophobia in the military, of sexual assaults in the military, all these really deep, systemic, huge problems in the military, for the most part, most of this is not getting coverage in the mainstream, and least of all, resistance in the military, whether it's folks like Jeff Key coming out on national TV to get himself kicked out of the military, or the Sergeant Travis Bishops, or the Aaron Watadas, or the Camille Mejias, or the Victor Augustos. Most of these folks are not getting mainstream coverage, because then, of course, that underscores what a growing number of people in the military are realizing. This is a deeply flawed foreign policy. Obama, not only is he not changing Bush policy, but he's continuing it and expanding it, and more people are opposing this, and morale is at an all-time low in the military. And that is what the mainstream media is refusing to cover. And what's interesting is, as these occupations continue, everything I just mentioned is going to increase. And so it's going to put the mainstream media in a position where at some point they're going to have to start covering some of this, because the military really is in a state of breakdown, and this is only going to increase with time.
When Obama was campaigning, he talked about actually withdrawing from Iraq and, you know, said some very rational things about peace. The majority of the voters voted for him. And now he is, as you say, continuing expanding the Bush policy against the will of the electorate. Do you understand why?
Well, I think Obama, you know, this is a guy who has, you know, effectively sold out on just about every cause that apparently he believed in. I mean, you know, basically running on an anti-war vote and sentiment in this country that was so strong, people so desperate for change after the blatant obviousness of the Bush administration of just this corporate capitalist war machine agenda, and him running as an antidote for that, and then basically betraying his constituents. It's very, very clear. This is a guy who, you know, whether it's the policy in Iraq, where he's done nothing but just carry forward with exact Bush policy that was laid out, he's made no change there whatsoever. With Afghanistan, he's done nothing but have a massive escalation of the use of military military force there. He's done nothing to end either, really, truly end either of these occupations. And then, you know, we look at his policy. You know, he goes from being good buddies with Palestinian intellectual Edward Said back in the early 90s to even before he was elected, going to AIPAC and giving the most hardcore right-wing pro-Israel speech, talking about a unified Jerusalem being the capital of the Jewish state of Israel. I mean, basically giving the finger to the Palestinians and the idea of a two-state solution. I mean, we can go on down the long list, you know, including health care in this discussion of how he's betrayed people who supported him. And at this point, aside from the fact that he's charismatic and gives articulate, clear, good speeches, and it's nice to have a president who can speak in complete sentences, at this point, I don't see how much more clear it needs to be made that not only is Obama not carrying forward with the Bush agenda, but he's simply carrying forward with the overall corporate government agenda that, you know, what the government of the United States is doing is not in our interests. It's simply in the interest of corporations and talking about Iraq and Afghanistan, specifically those who are profiting from war.
Dar Jamail is a journalist with the Interpress Service, Le Monde Diplomatique, many other media outlets. His two books are The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, and Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. Thanks so much for being with us, Dar.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Thanks to Cabby for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, the Jazz Experience.